From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about environmental issues and sustainable living. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
A research paper released last week on the open access peer review website Plus One suggests a linkage between the presence of pesticides and pollen, honeybee health, and colony collapse disorder.
Joining us in the first half of the show, it will be Dennis Van Ingelsdorp. He's an entomologist with the University of Maryland and a co-author of the paper linking bee health and pollen mixed with, at times, over a dozen different insecticides, herbicides, and fungicides.
And then in the second half of the show, we'll speak with Matt Pacenza. He's the policy director with Heal Utah, a nonprofit environmental advocacy group dedicated to educating the public on the need for the state to pursue cleaner renewable energy alternatives rather than coal, nuclear, or natural gas.
That's right. We'll talk to Matt about several energy issues, including the status of a proposed nuclear power plant along the Green River down at Green River, Utah. It's a crazy idea that will never work, right?
Well, Chris, you forget that we're in Utah. And if it's presented as jobs or an energy versus the environment issue, the environment will probably lose, even if that environment is supporting another sector of jobs.
Right. So, we'll talk about the Matt about that and all that, and a reminder about tonight's Composting 101 event being held at Summit Community Gardens. Of course, you can join in on today's buzz about honeybees, as well as all our topics, by posting your questions or comments to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth.
You are listening to This Green Earth, and it all gets started right after a few words from our underwriters.
This is Anne from Park City Nursery and the Park City Tree Ranch. We're proud to have helped KPCW grow and flourish since 1983. Park City Nursery and the Tree Ranch have a variety of products to help your yard and garden do the same. Flowers, seeds, shrubs, and trees, water-wise sprinklers, consulting, and landscaping. We know what grows at parkcitynursery.com.
This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for?
TED Radio Hour, Sunday morning at 10. Brought to you by Albion Financial Group and Board Docs.
Join us for The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Head into summer with us as we explore health, nutrition, and lifestyle with the experts.
From going gluten-free to finding your balance.
From bike position to relationship alignment.
From the educational journey to navigating wellness.
That's Wednesdays at 9 a.m. on The Mountain Life, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you by Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Park City Clinic, and Grand Valley Bank.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak, and she's Nell Larson across the board. And last week, Nell, an interesting paper was released on the website PLOS One, or we'll get the proper pronunciation of that.
That's right.
PLOS Plus One, which kind of suggests a linkage between the presence of pesticides. And when we say pesticides, we talk about insecticides, fungicides, herbicides, rodenticides. There's a family of pesticides that are out there. The linkage between those pesticides showing up in pollen, and then that pollen being collected by bees, and then that contaminated pollen affecting the health and welfare of the bees. And joining us to discuss this is one of the authors of this paper. His name is Dennis Van Ingelsdorp. He's an entomologist with the University of Maryland. And Dennis, thanks for joining Nell and myself on This Green Earth.
I appreciate your interest.
Let's start with this, Dennis. What was this the basic intent or goal and objective of this study?
Well, we know that bees have been dying at very high rates for the last 6 years. And when this first emerged, 2006, 2007, we started looking at it very carefully. We thought we would find one sort of smoking bullet mm-hmm. or smoking gun and be able to find a solution. And that quickly was proved not to be true. And so in this study, and we came up with different hypotheses. Was it pests and diseases of bees? Was it pesticides? Or was it nutrition? And now we think it's actually all three, and that they can act alone or in combination. And so in this particular study, we were looking at a combination effect. We wanted to see what was happening in the real world in terms of real-world exposure to pesticides that weren't killing the bees outright, but may affect them, may affect their long-term ability to fight infection. And
we were really interested in this category of what you called sublethal impacts to bees and insects in general. Can you talk about some of those sublethal effects?
Right. So sublethal effects are effects that don't outright kill the insect, but reduce its life expectancy or makes it more difficult for it to perform tasks. In this case, what we did was we fed this pollen, this pollen that had levels of pesticide in it, on average 9 different pesticides, up to 21 different pesticides in one sample. And we fed them to bees and then exposed those bees to a fungal infection. And we found that in the case of fungicides, and that was the real surprise, because fungicides don't kill bees. You can spray fungicides on bees and they'll fly away and they'll be fine. But when bees fed on this fungicide-laden pollen, they were two times or more likely to catch an infection with the fungal disease than if they were feeding pollen without this pollen, without the fungicide.
But that's the fungicide. And in addition, though, you were finding insecticides and sometimes herbicides in the same pollen, correct?
Well, that's right. We found up to 21 different pesticides, including herbicides and insecticides and fungicides. But the group that stood out were two groups. One was these fungicides, and one were the miticides that beekeepers apply to their hive to control varroa mites, which are these large parasitic vampire-like mites that feed on the blood of bees and also pass on viruses. Now, we've known for a long time that these miticides are bad for bees because what we're trying to do is kill a bug on a bug, essentially. But it's a lot like chemotherapy in the fact that you don't, you know, we know that the cancer is going to kill you. Chemotherapy isn't good for you, but it's sort of the best of two bad choices. We know varroa mites are going to kill colonies if we don't treat them. So that wasn't surprising that the miticides had an effect on the ability of the bees to fight infection. It was really surprising that this class of fungicides didn't. The other thing that was surprising, and you're always cautious with negative results, was that there weren't a lot of the other insecticides had measurable effects. We didn't show measurable increase in sublethal effects. Now, that could be because we were looking at different pollen, and some pollen is really good for bees, and so maybe it was this increased nutrition had a positive effect that counterbalanced this negative effect from the pesticides. But that's something we have to tease out with a more comprehensive study.
That's interesting. So another thing you found is that the pesticides that were coming in on the pollen that the bees brought back to the hives in these real-world situations were not just from the target pollination crop.
Right.
They were also from surrounding areas. How did that vary?
Well, that's a really good question. And that at first really surprised us, but then we thought about it and it wasn't as surprising. And I'll explain that here in a sec. First of all, so we brought these to a whole bunch of different crops. Two of those crops were old world crops, so they came from Europe or Asia, apples and almonds. And apple and Europe and Asia is where honeybees evolved, and so they've sort of evolved together, apples and honeybees. And so bees are really good at collecting apple pollen, and apple pollen is really good at sticking on honeybees. However, we also pollinated new world crops, so cranberries and blueberries, for instance. And these plants haven't evolved with honeybees. They've evolved with other pollinators, like bumblebees. And so they have a different way of getting pollen and collecting pollen. So we think what's happening is that the bees, the honeybees, are just not very efficient at collecting this pollen and bringing it back home. That's not saying that they're not pollinating the crops. They're still good at vibrating the flower, and so pollen is getting passed on. They're just not good at collecting it and bringing it home. Despite this, though, we found high levels of agricultural chemicals in the pollen the bees did bring home. Now, those flowers could have been in the same field. They could have been on the margins of the field, or they could have been somewhere else. And it's possible that even the bees visiting just to collect nectar of these flowers were picking up the pesticides and then passing it on to the pollen they were taking home. We don't understand that, and I think that that's something we have to do a little bit more research on, is figuring out the pathway of pesticides. How do these pesticides go from the field and into the hive?
Okay, yeah, let's get a little more background on the study itself. This was performed in areas in New Jersey and Maryland, farmers who were raising, growing almonds, blueberries, cranberries, cranberry bogs, etc. They allowed you onto their property and collect the pollen from these crops, correct?
No, so what we did was we went with beekeepers who were being paid to pollinate these different crops.
Okay.
And so we would go with them, and we would set up 9 hives in 3 different fields, and we would put a trap in front of the colony that would knock the pollen off the bees as they entered. And so we would collect these pollen pellets, and then we would sort those by type, because different plants produce different colors, and then we can look under the microscope to identify the pollen. And then we would analyze that pollen for pesticides. And then we would take some more of that pollen, and we would feed it to newly emerged bees, bees that are a day old. And then we would feed some of those bees with the fungal disease to check for their infection rate.
Okay. If you just join us, we're speaking with Dennis Van Elgensdorp. He's an entomologist with the University of Maryland. He's also an editor with the online research website, PLOS1. How do you pronounce that, Dennis? What's the best?
PLOS. I always say PLOS, but yeah.
PLOS1. It was a paper posted on the website last week. The full title of it is Crop Pollination Exposes Honeybees to Pesticides, which Alters Their Susceptibility to the Gut Pathogen Nosema serinae. Now, we'll talk a little more. We want to talk a little more about PLOS1, about who they are and what they do, because it's a really fascinating website. But let's talk about now this gut pathogen. Again, the relationship between the appearance of all these, this kind of cocktail of pesticides, and how that increases, I guess, the susceptibility of these bees to this gut pathogen. Is that correct?
Right. So when they fed on different types of pollens, it increased their likelihood of catching the infection. And we found this with fungicides, which was particularly surprising, was the fungicidal effect. The Nosema is a fungal disease of adult bees. And, you know, sometimes it can be a real problem and kill colonies outright. Usually it's a background problem that in combination of other things can cause the colony to decline. And Nosema serrana is a species that actually just came over in the 80s, so it's relatively new. And we still don't really quite understand exactly what its population dynamics are. But it's very widespread. Most beekeepers have it. Mm-hmm. So it's a very common disease of bees.
And yet this disease can be very lethal to the hive
itself.
Well,
that's right. Right. When it gets at very high levels, it can kill the colony.
Okay.
And so if you're increasing the susceptibility of the bees, certainly that's predisposing those colonies to die.
Okay.
So this, you know, bee, you know, colony collapse disorder and that kind of thing has been in the news a lot. Is there a lot of research going on similar to yours about bees and why we're seeing these die-offs?
Well, yes, and again, I think that what we're realizing is that it's a complicated story, and so that means that a lot of different people have to look at different angles. And so we think that that pests are playing a very big role, so there are a lot of people looking at varroa mite and other viruses and other diseases of bees. We're looking at pesticides, both that the beekeeper is applying and the farmer is applying and the bees are bringing back to the hive, and nutrition. And again, we've seen a lot of land that traditionally was good forage for bees. So a lot of land in the Dakotas, where a lot of bees move every year to summer, a lot of that land is being plowed under and planted with corn and soybeans. And so there's less and less good forage areas for bees to survive on. So we think it's a combination of these things. Poor nutrition, pests and diseases, and pesticides can act in synergy together to predispose colonies to die at the alarming rates we're seeing.
So one thing you mentioned right at the start of the interview is that we started seeing these high rates of bees dying about 6 years ago. Is there a theory as to why it started so suddenly?
Well, I think that if we put it in historical context, we've been noticing a decline in the bee population since the 1940s. So we've lost half of the colonies in this country over the last 50, 60 years.
Wow.
Which is an awful lot. And we've been concerned about this for a long time. What sort of happened in 2006, 2007 was that people who had 2,000-3,000 colonies 1 month would come back a month later and find 2,000 of those 3,000 dead. And that was new. Since then, we started really monitoring losses. And even though we don't see the classic symptoms of CCD, that sudden loss of the adult population very much anymore, mm-hmm. we're still seeing 30% or better of the colonies every winter dying. Now, having said that, if you count the bees right now in August in the country, that number has been about the same every year for the last 6 years. And that's because beekeepers are able to replace dead colonies very quickly. And so if you have a live colony and a dead colony, you can split that live colony in half and add a queen, and you have two colonies. But that's a very expensive prospect. And so we're at the point where a lot of these large commercial beekeepers that we rely on to move colonies around the country to pollinate different crops aren't able to be sustainable, and we're worried they're going to go out of business.
Well, I find it really fascinating about this, going back to this concept of this cocktail of pesticides, because I forgot the fact that not only could it be coming from the farmer, because the farmer could spray their crops several times, once for, let's say, control aphids, so there's an insecticide, once to control weeds, so there's an herbicide, once to control fungus, so there's a fungicide. But then the beekeeper themselves might be applying a chemical to, like you say, a miticide to control mites, but then the bees are off, let's say, foraging in somebody's yard, who they themselves are spraying, a private individual. Municipalities spray along roadsides to control weeds. These poor guys can't get out of the way of potential chemicals in their pollen. They're just overwhelmed, and the stuff they bring back to the hive is just at times probably just so contaminated, but they can't avoid it. Even organic, right? That's what this concept of organic honey is, we've been told, is kind of a misnomer, a challenge.
Well, certainly you can't produce organic honey unless you're 2 miles away from a paved road, which is very difficult to do.
Yeah.
Except in some regions in the jungles of Costa Rica and stuff, so there's some legitimate organic honey out there.
Right.
But the whole pesticides, and I think that you bring up a very good point, because we often blame farmers, and I don't think farmers are the only person to blame. If you look at backyard gardeners, they use many times more pesticides per acre than any farmer ever does.
Wow.
And that's because they sort of squirt a squirt of pesticide and think, oh, it's not dead yet, let me squirt another one. And so they are largely responsible. And also, I think the solution relies on having a multi-pronged effort to save bees. And so why is it that we're controlling, you know, weeds are another name for flowering plants in most cases, and that's good bee forage. So why are we spraying the sides of roads and mowing the sides of roads when we could be growing good bee forage there, mm-hmm. and healthy bee forage? And so I think that we have to start thinking about that. Also, why is it that we think that the perfect green lawn is a beautiful thing? Wouldn't it be better to have sort of a meadow of flowering plants that sustains our pollinator supply, which is vital?
Absolutely. We got a couple more minutes. What's the media coverage of this been like? I know I picked it up in the LA Times. What kind of response are you getting?
You know, the whole story since CCD struck in 2006, 2007, we as scientists aren't used to a lot of media attention, and certainly there's been an amazing amount of interest from the media, and I think that reflects the general population's interest in bees. I think that bees somehow resonate with something deep within us, and I think that we know that if bees are in trouble, that's an indicator that something bigger and larger than ourselves is in trouble. And so I think everyone, it resonates. It's a story that resonates with everyone. In this particular story, actually, I've been a little bit surprised at how much people have been paying attention to this paper. We've published a lot of papers. Few have received the attention this one has. There was one magazine that said they had 2.75 million hits within 2 days on the story.
What?
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
That's incredible. Well, it raises Nell and Mai's antenna, so to speak, because we cover bees quite a bit. Because we recognize they are a huge issue. That you know, some people have suggested that 1/3 of the fruits and vegetables or food that's on our plate comes through bee pollination in one form or another. So they're incredibly important.
So speaking actually of one recent piece that we did on bees, we talked about the impacts of neonicotinoids on bees. And though that family, I guess, of mm-hmm. chemicals was kind of being pointed at as sort of like the main cause for some of these bee issues. What's your response to that? It seems like you guys are finding some different results.
I think that response is a little bit simplistic, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I wish it was that simple. I wish that saying, okay, let's get rid of neonics and our problems would go away. I think that that's not the case. I think that, sure, neonics, when you expose bees to neonics, it's not good for bees. That's clear. But survey after survey, we're not seeing high levels of neonics consistently across the board. We're seeing a lot of fungicide. We're seeing, and we're measuring very dramatic effects, sublethal effects on fungicide. And so I worry that concentrating the effort on just this one class of insecticides, where if we do a broader approach and follow the data, I wonder whether that is a better way to come up with a solution. Insecticides and neonics are not good for bees. Neither are all the pesticides, but they're sort of a part of modern agriculture. And so I think that we have to figure out ways to make everything as safe as possible for pollinators. And I don't know that neonics are the sort of the DDT of our current era.
Yeah. Hey, we got about a minute or so left. Talk to us a little bit about PLOS One, the website, what that's all about.
Yeah, so PLOS One is an online scientific journal. The idea is that it's open access, so you don't have to pay to read the articles. It's fairly new. I'm editor on that, and there are hundreds of different editors. It's meant to go to have a really quick turnaround time, so results get out quickly. And I think it's sort of this new era of releasing scientific information so everyone has access to it. You don't have to be part of a university or pay really exorbitant registration fees to see the research in its raw and published form.
Yeah, it's great. There's papers, like dozens of papers that seem to be posted almost every day in an array of topics, not just environmental issues, but any area of science. It's a fascinating. What's the website?
I think I would Google PLOS One. Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. Yes.
You know what?
You know what? I've got the paper in front of me here. It is PLOS1.org. There it is.
Thank you, Nell.
There you go.
Way to go, Nell. Thanks for joining us. Hey, Dennis Van Inglesdorp, thanks for joining Nell and myself on This Green Earth. Again, Dennis is an entomologist with the Department of Entomology at the University of Maryland. We were talking about the paper he helped co-author entitled Crop Pollination Exposes Honeybees to Pesticides, which alters their susceptibility to the gut pathogen Nosema serenae. And again, Dennis, thanks for joining us. I think we'll be talking to you some more down the road. This topic always is fascinating and should not be overlooked. So thanks.
Great.
Again.
I appreciate your interest.
All right. Hey, let's take a break for some underwriters. And when we come back, it's Matt Pazenza from Heal Utah. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Red Ledges is a proud supporter of KPCW and minutes away from Park City with custom homes and home sites, golf, tennis, and other amenities. Red Ledges has four seasons of opportunities. More information at redledges.com.
Hi, this is Gordon Raymond at Republic Services, a proud sponsor of KPCW. Gray is for garbage. Those four words will help you remember the current waste and recycling program. Your blue or brown bin is for recyclables. Gray is for garbage. AlliedWasteUtah.com/Summit County.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's the happening.
Summer's here.
Shh. Summer's where? Wait, Jan, it's here?
Uh-oh. Don't tell anybody about Park City's summer secrets.
It's a secret? But, John, isn't that our job, telling Park City who's got savory summer snacks and where the sizzle and fun is?
Secrets out for summer. Find out what all the cool kids are up to this summer. Tune in to Fun Friday at 9 a.m.
Brought to you by the Summit County Fair.
All Seasons Adventures.
Park City Sunday Market.
Zermatt Resort and Spa.
And the Homestead Resort.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I am Nell Larson, and that's Chris Cherniak across the board.
Waving.
waving at all of you over the radio. And here in the studio with us for the second half of the show is Matt Pacenza. He's the policy director with Heal Utah, a nonprofit environmental advocacy group, and he'll tell us what they're all about today. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning, Nell. Good morning, Chris.
So let's start with that simple question of what is Heal Utah and what do you guys do?
Yeah, great. We're a nonprofit group based in Salt Lake, which does advocate on behalf of folks throughout Utah. And broadly put, we seek to protect Utah from nuclear toxics and dirty energy risks. And we're basically a citizen advocacy organization. So our primarily sort of tool for trying to achieve that mission is to channel the energy and activism of ordinary Utahns to make change on, you know, legislature and regulatory bodies and elsewhere.
And how long has Heal Utah been around?
Yeah, it's been around like about 12 years. It was born out of some neighborhood toxics fights. There was an initial group called Families Against Incinerator Risk, which was born in the West Desert and concerned about the Chemical Army Depot and MagCorp and some other facilities out there. And then they united with some other groups in the broader Salt Lake area and became HEAL, I think, about 11, 12 years ago.
And the HEAL is actually stands for something, right?
Yeah, we've tended to move away from the acronym and just stick with the Heal Utah, but
okay,
it's called the Healthy Environmental Alliance of Utah, but Heal Utah is good enough.
All right. Sounds good.
So, all right, so we'll bounce around about different types of energy and stuff, but I want to talk about this idea about building a nuclear power plant down at Green River, Utah, right, in that area along the Green River. Okay, this is an idea. Whose idea is this, and where does it stand?
Sure thing. So it first surfaced in 2007 when a then-state legislator, Representative Aaron Tilton, who represents Springville, sort of was involved in some committee hearings on the question of nuclear power. And at one point on a disclosure form that was spotted by a clever reporter, he noted that he had a conflict of interest. And someone asked about that, and it turned out that he was sort of secretly might be judgmental, but also might be accurate, was secretly plotting to put together a company to, in fact, develop Utah's first commercial nuclear power plant. Since then, Representative Tilton has put together, to be fair, a fairly impressive team of folks who have come together into a company called Blue Castle Holdings. And beyond Aaron Tilton, it includes a former GE executive, a former NRC commissioner, a former state energy advisor, and some pretty bigwig folks. And so they have spent the last, I suppose, about 6 years trying to make this happen. And their primary achievement, unfortunately, was getting state approval for a water rights transfer. So they have managed to lease the water they need, which, of course, in Utah, when you want to do something big, getting water is, your first and in many ways your biggest challenge. So they did succeed on that front. There's other fronts they have been less successful on, and we personally think the project is struggling. Mm-hmm. But it is certainly still alive and moving forward, and we can get into some details, but we face a court date in a few months on it as well.
So let's dig in a little bit on the water rights. That was definitely, I think, when Chris and I first heard about this project, we were both thinking, how the heck are they going to get this water? So How did they get this water?
Yeah, I mean, it's
and how much?
It's a classic Utah story. It involves politics and you know, backroom deals and all that kind of thing. So Representative Tilton was on a legislative committee with the fairly infamous Representative Mike Noel. And Representative Noel is not just a state representative and a rancher, but also the executive director of a rural water conservancy district, in this case, Kanab County. And so water conservancy districts in the states have a variety of water at their disposal. Among those are what are called appropriated but unused water rights. So this is water that you have the right to take out of a body of water but you haven't used yet. And Kane County had a bunch of that water, as did San Juan County, you know, both southern rural Utah counties. So they struck a deal with Blue Castle Holdings, that had a different name then, but you know, this the same entity, to lease 53,000 acre feet of water. And it's a ton of water, and to translate it into, you know, something that we can all wrap our heads around, it's as much water as a city of 200,000 people would use. So it's a tremendous amount of water. And they were able to lease it. And then in Utah, when you do that, that requires state approval from an official called the state engineer. And that process kicked off, I think, in like 2008 or 9. It was a two-year process. We and dozens of other, several hundred other activists and organizations and individuals and farmers and business owners and river rafting companies and a bunch of other folks basically, to use a technical term, protested it and said, this is nonsense. It's a terrible use of the water. Nuclear power is, you know, not what Utah needs. It's dangerous, a bunch of other things. Unfortunately, the state engineer did side with Blue Castle Holdings about a year and a half ago. And we then chose, along with a dozen other plaintiffs, to take them to court and to seek to have that decision overturned. And we now believe that we will actually have a court date in late September.
That's so. Wait, so where is this water coming from? Is it going to be coming right out of the Green River?
Yeah, it would come right out of the Green River. The reactor site, the proposed reactor site, is an industrial park. Although this is actually really just words on paper. There's no industrial park yet, but it's a plot of land right near where Route 6, the road that comes down from Price to I-70. Meets I-70. So if you can imagine, when you're driving to Moab, you're on Route 6 for a while there along that valley with the reef on your left, and then you hit I-70. You then make a left on I-70 and head toward the village of Green River. That point where those two roads meet is where the reactor project would be. The water would then be piped in roughly, I think, about 4 miles from the Green River itself, from the village of Green River, roughly. Those two locations are both about 4 miles away. So it's not literally on the banks of the river, no, but just a few miles away there.
Right.
That is a shocking amount of water, though. I liked how you sort of gave us the equivalent. 200,000-person city would use a similar amount of water.
And plus, the water has to be clean for nuclear power. You need clean water. This is mostly cooling water. Well, it's cooling water, but it still needs to be clean. The Green River doesn't always run very clean. So it requires a lot of treatment, and then that water requires to be cooled because it can't just be discharged back into the river. It has to be discharged probably under ambient conditions. So there's a lot of engineering.
Just one quick clarification that if they get permission to do this, and obviously we'll fight them and we don't think they will, but if they were to, the design that they have proposed is actually a sort of closed loop. And what that means is water wouldn't go back to the river. So they would pull the water they need from the river. They would put it in a cooling tower. They would circulate it throughout the project. And then as they needed to replenish the water that was lost through the process, they would pull more from the river. But they wouldn't actually send water
back
to the river.
Okay.
Yeah. So let's talk about – all right. So we've talked about this water piece of the issue. What are some of Heal Utah's other concerns about this project?
Yeah, I mean, I think that obviously water itself is, and we can just talk about that briefly for a second. So, you know, we live in a state which is already pushing the boundaries of having enough water to live the lives that we're living. And I have married to a longtime Utah family, and my father-in-law lives in central Utah in San Pete County. And they already, year to year, have severe problems with not having enough water. They rely upon, you know, snowpack and snowmelt, and they, you know, we've had so many years recently where we don't have sufficient snow. And the last audience on earth I need to tell that are folks in Park City. And so Utah already faces a water crisis. We have a population slated to double, which is, I think, a kind of a stomach punch figure, but certainly what every demographer says, slated to double in the next roughly 40 years. And here we are contemplating investing a massive amount of water in a project that has a whole bunch of other concerns that I'll get into. So certainly we think it's a poor use of water in a state already grappling with water difficulties. In addition to that, frankly, the number one thing that has really doomed nuclear power in America and the world is that it costs too much. It really is a quite expensive way to make electricity. These are massive facilities. They require a tremendous amount of raw materials, you know, steel and concrete and the like. They require these extremely elaborate and sophisticated sort of engineered safety systems because they've tended to have accidents. And those things are really, really pricey. And the truth is that utilities in America stopped building nuclear power in roughly sort of the early 1980s. Now part of that was a series of high-profile accidents, Three Mile Island and Chernobyl prominently. But honestly, as big an issue or a bigger issue is simply that American utilities, who don't really particularly care about what kind of power they acquire, looked around and saw that, frankly, coal and certainly natural gas were cheaper. In the modern era, it's natural gas, which is definitely cheaper, and frankly, wind. Wind power has come way down in price. It's cost competitive with pretty much every other source. And certainly both wind and natural gas are much cheaper alternatives to nuclear. So water and cost are the big issues that we talk about all the time. You know, safety is worth talking about. It produces dangerous nuclear waste that we don't have a permanent solution to. A lot of that waste comes to Utah, disposed of by Energy Solutions, 80 miles west of Salt Lake. We have had a series of nuclear accidents, including most recently Fukushima. I would be the first to say personally that, you know, the likelihood of a serious nuclear accident at a Green River nuclear reactor is low. Most reactors do operate safely. But nonetheless, when you do have accidents, the consequences can be severe.
Sure.
And so it is certainly worth factoring that in. I don't think folks should run around and say, if we build nuclear power in Utah, we'll all turn into, you know, little green mutants. But at the same time, you know, you can't spill wind. Wind don't blow up.
Right.
It's high stakes.
Yeah.
Yeah. When things go wrong, things go really, really wrong. That's one of the issues with nuclear power. What would you say is right now our percentage of the electricity that comes in our home? How do you break that down by coal, natural gas, wind?
So we're talking about Rocky Mountain Power customers in Utah?
Yeah.
So it's a little hard. These are numbers that they are a lot like nailing Jell-O to the wall for a variety of very complicated reasons that we don't need to bore listeners with. But we'll give a very brief, a very sort of close estimate. And it would be roughly two-thirds coal, let's say 65% coal, let's say 10%, 12% natural gas, let's say about 10% hydro, and about 8% renewables, mostly wind, pretty much all wind, a touch of geothermal. So, you know, Utah has among the dirtiest power mix in the country, and that's driven by Rocky Mountain Power and its decision making. And overall, we're at about 80% roughly of our power from fossil fuels, and most of that is coal power.
And so none of our current energy stream in Utah comes from nuclear.
That is correct. There's very little nuclear power in the West in general. And the biggest reason by far is the lack of water. I mean, this is not rocket science. If you look at where America's nuclear power plants are built, you'll see them along massive bodies of water, oceans, and big rivers and lakes, the Great Lakes. There's a lot around the Great Lakes. There's, you know, some along the Mississippi and the Missouri and the Ohio and the Hudson. And then you see some along the coasts. So we all love Utah's rivers. They're glorious, beautiful rivers, obviously, but they're not huge. You know, I grew up in the Northeast, and I look at the Colorado and the Green, and I think, good God, the Hudson's a lot bigger river than these are.
Exactly.
Know? Yeah. I mean, these aren't massive bodies of water. They don't have an outrageous amount of water in them. And so for that reason, there is one nuclear power plant in Arizona, and there are some along the California coast, and I believe one in Washington State. But in the Mountain West, we have zero.
No, and that's why we have zero in the mountain, because there's not enough water.
Right.
That's why there's no nuclear power in Wyoming, Montana, or Idaho, or New Mexico. There's not enough water.
Okay. So how much energy would this proposed plant create?
Yeah, that's a bit of a moving target, but okay. They Blue Castle's at a point where they don't have to 100% say exactly what their design would be. But what they have suggested is they would build two reactors. It's a design from Westinghouse, and that together those would approximately produce 3,000 megawatts, which is a ton of electricity. The entire state of Utah right now is using about 6,000 megawatts. So theoretically, it could supply half the state. Now, we don't have demand anywhere near that. Obviously, our population is growing, and we do have some demand. But the Rocky Mountain Power is able to meet that demand partly by sort of ratcheting up current facilities, partly by buying power in the open market. We're actually doing a decent job in the reducing demand because of energy efficiency programs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've got some plans to basically add some natural gas over the next decade or so. So there's no real need for this power. What's kind of hilarious, and we're sort of baffled as to why the proposal is sort of lurching and stumbling forward, because Rocky Mountain Power itself told a news reporter back about 6 months ago that they had no interest in the project. So if the utility that supplies 80-85% of Utah's power doesn't want this electricity, it's really almost impossible to see where the market for it would be. Some folks think it's other states, but, mm-hmm. you know, and you could put it on the grid and get it to, let's say, California, Nevada, mm-hmm. Arizona, New Mexico, places like that. But those places also have their own plans of where they're getting electricity. And they don't, it doesn't really seem like any of them would want to lock themselves into a long-term contract to buy expensive power from a facility like this, which might never get built because so many of these don't get built. So, you know, we think it's doomed in the long term, but in the short to medium term, we have no choice to fight it. Right. It is lurching forward. They do have some money. They do have some powerful people on board. They unfortunately appear to have the support of Governor Herbert and other state officials. So
what is the timeline for future permitting, next steps? How quickly is this moving along?
Yeah, so basically, nuclear power in the United States is essentially all about federal permits. And that explains why we fought so hard on the water and continue to, because really the only point at which the state of Utah was allowed to weigh in was on this water rights thing. There's no vote of the legislature. There's no up or down vote of the governor. There's nothing like that. Water was our main way to stop it locally. So if they do withstand our court challenge, and obviously we hope they don't, but if they do, their next step is to apply to the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, a federal agency. It's a very expensive and time-consuming and thorough process. They would literally have to put together like thousands of pages of documents, cost tens of millions of dollars. And they have claimed that there's something like a third of the way done, I think, or 40% of the way done putting that application together. But they also keep constantly pushing out the date at which they would submit that. So, I mean, at one point they said 2009 or 2010. Here we are in 2013. I think they're now saying 2014, but frankly, I don't see how that's remotely possible. So, but if they were to get that in and then it were to be approved, then they would basically have 20 years in which to, you know, put together financing and begin construction and make it happen. So that's one of the things that annoys us a lot, is that we feel like, you know, there's so much against this project, economics, so much more. But if they do manage to get this license, then we'd have the specter hanging out there for decades that if the numbers ever turn in their favor, or if, frankly, a dumb utility executive somewhere sort of falls in love with nuclear power despite the fact that he or she shouldn't, you know, it could get built. So we're really, really bound and determined to try to win this water thing, and if not, to try to beat them in the NRC and just try to keep this license from sitting out there.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Matt Pacenza. He is the policy director with Heal Utah. Heal Utah is a nonprofit environmental advocacy group that, among other things, attempts to educate the public on the need for the state of Utah to pursue cleaner, renewable energy alternatives rather than the usual coal, nuclear, and natural gas. Hey, I got a question from a listener in Chicago who wants to talk about a clean air campaign that Heal Utah is involved. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure thing. Yeah, we've gotten involved in clean air more in the last year or two. As you folks, you know, you guys are lucky up here, of course, that you're, you know, above the inversion layer and some of the ozone problems, although increasingly, right, like the Heber Valley's got some air quality mm-hmm. problems.
Right.
But down, obviously, along the Wasatch Front, Salt Lake, you know, from Logan to Provo, you know, we have a fairly serious air quality problem. And Heal, within the past year or two, has tried to figure out, you know, we didn't want to do work in that area just to do it. There's a bunch of other really good groups doing great work. But we have sort of zeroed in on the transportation sector, which felt like the area which there was less activism happening and there was rooms for some good policy changes that could happen. So I'm not sure if the listener is referring to this, but we spent a few months recently trying to marshal support for an EPA proposal, which would dramatically clean up our cars and our gasoline. So it essentially involves lowering the sulfur content in gasoline dramatically, mm-hmm. and also requiring some really sophisticated pollution control technologies in new vehicles. And if those two things do go in effect, and we're basically waiting for the EPA to issue final rules right now, then it could clean up what comes out of your tailpipe by about 70-80%. So it's a big deal. Cars and trucks are the single biggest source of our air pollution problem along the Wasatch Front. And if this goes into effect, it's going to help dramatically. Now, we're talking about a long-term solution, mm-hmm. because it takes a while to replace the cars, especially here in the West where we don't have rust as much. It takes a couple decades to get a new set of cars into place. But when you look ahead to 2025, 2030, that time frame, there's rooms for optimism, and the transportation sector is definitely one of those.
Right, and you're probably not the only group that's involved in this area. There are other nonprofit environmental advocacy groups down the Salt Lake Valley that you could team up with to achieve this goal, like perhaps Breathe Utah or something like that.
That's a great example. There's probably the one group that is most involved directly is Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment, which is a terrific organization, and which has targeted by and large industry and industrial pollution, and that's an extremely important area to take a close look at. And folks like the Docs and Utah Moms for Clean Air have asked this very important question, which is, does it make sense to have, for example, massive oil refineries in the middle of a valley with a population of 1 million people and a severe air quality problem?
Good question.
And then you can look at Rio Tinto, and that starts to become a more complicated question, and they do have a tremendous economic impact, but they are, in fact, a big polluter. So,
And like you said, Matt, this is an area that's going to looking to be doubling in population size, which means even more emitters in the form of cars, trucks, buses, etc.
Yeah.
So the air quality challenges down there are large and not going away anytime soon, and that's why we need groups like yours to educate the public on the value of better fuel efficiency, fuel conservation, alternatives to fossil fuel powered vehicles.
Yeah, and I think that I'm a little more optimistic maybe than some environmentalists, and I think that actually, one thing we've really noticed in the last few years along the Wasatch Front is that I think the powers that be are becoming increasingly aware of it, that Utah's economy is doing great relatively. And there's a bunch of reasons why. We have a young population. We have an educated population, lots of immigrants that have helped. But a big part of it is the quality of life stuff. People want to move here. People want to live here because it's just gorgeous and it's just like close to just these amazing things. And if we start to get the rep as like the new LA, the new smog capital, dark, choking, nasty, dense, yucky fog, then, all of these, the backcountry.coms and the Black Diamonds and the L3s and all these, fast growing companies that have moved here and are hiring and are growing our economy are going to look around and they're going to find somewhere else. So it's a real serious issue, not just for our health, but for our economy.
Right. It's the new Beijing. Why go to Beijing?
That's not a title that we want.
Exactly.
So one other thing that HEAL Utah has worked on is sort of a cleaner energy plan for the state. So in an ideal world, what could Utah's, energy portfolio look like? Where could we get our energy from as opposed to the coal where we're getting it right now?
Yeah, I mean, we're so far behind on this front that we have so much to make up. I was asked once what grade I would give Utah on renewables, and I decided it was somewhere between an F minus and a G plus. So we're just way behind. We of power made in the state, 3-4% comes from renewables. Of power that Rocky Mountain Power is selling us, which is partly made here, partly made elsewhere, it's somewhere in that 6-8% range. And You know, our utilities have just failed us. They have just chosen to not really build any sign of big, significant facilities, and wind would certainly be the obvious place, although solar is certainly dropping in price as well. And so we showed this in a study a couple of years ago called eUtah, and now we are moving toward trying to put that into effect. And some of that work is happening up here, and some of your listeners, I'm sure, know about it because we've given talks and had house parties and done work like that. We've presented in front of the Summit County Council and the like. So we look at an area like Park City and like Summit County, and we know that there is unmet demand up here. There are people that are more than willing to pay, and it, frankly, not that much more, but perhaps a little bit more, to directly buy wind and solar power. And we know that Rocky Mountain Power has failed us and isn't allowing us to do that. So we're trying to figure out a bunch of things. We're looking at places like Austin, Texas, which have these super cool models where people can directly buy those resources. And we are hoping to get your city council and your county councils and your elected officials to sort of ask for that, and then we'll take that and we'll go to the state legislature, because this would require some changes in state law to allow these sort of green buying co-op plans to go into effect. But we sort of have, frankly, kind of half given up on Rocky Mountain Power. They want to, you know, sell us these little blue sky credits and make us feel good about them, but the truth is they're not really, you know, moving the ship at all. So it's time to find other models that work. Other places are innovating. It's time for Utah to catch up.
All right.
Perfect. Well, let's leave it at that. Matt Pacenza, Policy Director at HEAL Utah. Matt, the website?
HEALUtah.org, and of course, Facebook and Twitter as well.
Perfect. Matt, thanks again for joining us and sharing us that information. Let's take a quick break for some underwriters. When we come back, we'll get a little update on calendar events. Composting 101. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Mark your calendars August 2nd and 3rd for Wasatch County Fair Days, featuring the Mountain Valley Stampede Rodeo at 7:30 p.m. with cowboys, rodeo clown, and NFR stock. Stick horse races for the kids and fireworks spectacular both nights. Tickets and information at wasatchcountyevents.com. Heber Valley Tourism is a nonprofit organization.
Since 1983, we've been trying to say something clever in support of our favorite radio station. This is Anne from Park City Nursery and the Park City Tree Ranch, complimenting KPCW for making interesting radio under strict regulations. We try to do the same given our short growing season, various microclimates and soils. We know what grows at parkcitynursery.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, the weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. It's, well, time to wrap up, but we do have a calendar event item, Nell.
Yes, we talked about this last week, but tonight is the Composting 101 workshop that the Summit Community Gardens is putting on in conjunction with the Park City Leadership Class, which I am a member of, full disclosure there. So that's at 5:30 p.m. at the Community Garden, and there will also be a limited number of those discounted and subsidized Earth Machine composters for sale. We've got a few left. So perfect. We would encourage anybody with questions to come out and get some more information.
All right. That's great. Let's thank our underwriters, as always, for whom this show would not be possible without. They include Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough.
Republic Services.
Habitat for Humanity's Restore.
Rocky Mountain Power.
Yeah, San Francisco Design.
Albion Financial.
And Prudential Utah Real Estate. Of course, you can always join us or post your comments or questions or ideas for topics you'd like us to cover on our Facebook page, KPCW, This Green Earth.
And you can also email us at thisgreenearthradio@gmail.com.
All right. Thanks again for joining us. Remember, this is KPCW Park City, only in Park City, only on KPCW. This is KPCW Park City, and we'll see you next week on This Green Earth.